श्रील गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री हरि नाम संकीर्तन की जय, श्री श्री दवजी गोपाल की जय, गौर भक्त वृंद की जय, गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल। सो प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू, गुड इवनिंग, वेलकम, थैंक्स फॉर coming and to all of those connected online as well, those connected online here, not those connected online here, just in case. So we are having today Easter Gosti again, questions and answers, and inviting whoever would like to present any topics or any ideas. And there's one question also that, there's one question sent here by Namrasa, who is connected, and also one question that was sent by Ashwin Jagtiani, who was one question that from the last meeting. So what do you think? Can you give priority to the online fellows? Yeah. Okay. Yes? Okay. The audience here is merciful today, at least for a while, let's see. So let's start with some of these questions, and then of course if any of you have further inquiries we can proceed. So I'll begin with the first question, was sent by Ashwin Jagtiani actually last Sunday, and last Sunday we only addressed one single question of the many. So the question says like this. Sometimes it is said Vaishnavas serving as gurus suffer due to the actions of their disciples. Recently, many of Srila Prabhupada's senior disciples caught COVID in India. And this point was heavily implied in the social media updates. But this contrary to the understanding that Ananya Bhaktas are directly under the control of Krishna's internal potency. As a result, sometimes disciples, to protect their guru, who is undergoing bodily discomfort, adopt almost vigilant behavior against disciples who have fallen away. Is this behavior anukul or favorable to bhakti? At the same time, Rupa Goswami warns that one should not accept too many unqualified disciples just to increase the sampradaya numbers. How to understand and reconcile? So, there are different points in one, of course, one single question, but with many considerations in it, and begging for sangati. No? Sangati means basically like reconciliation of facts, you know, how to accommodate all these different things that seem not to be too much aligned with one another, but that ideally should. So let's go part by part with the different sections of the question, because there are some different implications that are to be addressed. So first of all, speaks mentioned that sometimes it is said that Vaishnavas serving as gurus suffer due to the actions of their disciples. To begin with, of course, yeah, I know that sometimes that is said, but it's important that whenever we hear that sometimes something is said, that somehow we are able to locate the source of those ideas, because sometimes so many things are said. I mean, not sometimes, every time. At every moment, every time, everything is said. every possible thing is being said about all this stuff. But the point is, where does it coming from? No, is that in Shastra? Is that presented in our revealed scriptural canon? Or is that something that at some point someone said and it kind of became tradition out of just oral transmission without further understanding of the background of that, which may be a form of niyamagraha, which means following some rule or some statement without understanding its background and purpose. So the question will be actually, where in Shastra is this say? No, is it say that the guru will suffer due to the actions of their disciples? And if that is so, in which sense that is said? No, because we can locate that in Shastra, and things like this are mentioned here and there in one form. But it's not only enough to say, yeah, yes, I found the quote. Here it is said. If the disciple that does this, the guru suffers. Or if a disciple misbehaves, the guru suffers. Yes, in which sense? Because sometimes this idea is, okay, the guru disciple no longer has karma, but now the guru is taking your karma. And you may have different ideas about that. What does it mean? Like, from the moment I accept my guru, my previous karma is off, or from now on for eternity, whatever nonsense I do, that goes to his account, not to mine, or what? In which sense he deals with our karma? Is karma transmittable? or whatever, no? So there are many considerations just with this first line. So to begin with, actually, the idea is that, yes, of course, a guru suffered due to the actions of their disciple. That's a good way to put it. No? Here she's not mentioning guru is receiving all the karma load from their disciples or something. But the guru suffered because of the actions of their disciples. I mean, the actions, the wrong actions, of course. If the disciple is behaving properly, guru is not supposed to suffer. But if the disciple misbehaves, the guru will suffer because the guru is like a loving father. So if the loving father sees their children doing nonsense, he won't celebrate that. She won't celebrate that. I mean, they want their children to prosper spiritually. So they will be affected. It's a personal, intimate connection, guru-disciple, as we spoke the other day. The norm, if you will, ideally, between guru and disciple is Vishrambena Guru Seva. How I am to engage in my relationship with my guru, because we say we are to serve the guru in the spirit of Vishramba. Vishramba means, as we spoke this on Sunday, we could translate that even as intimacy, confidence, intimacy, close responsibility and trust. All the things make for real intimacy. Confidence, trust, responsibility. So I am to relate to him, to her in those terms. But why? Why to begin with, I will be willing to do so? Because I will perceive before that person is already doing that in relation to me. Now, of course, when the Shastra say, Vishrambena Guru Seva, serve your guru with that level of connection, it means ideally it is reciprocal and the guru is also doing that. To begin with, and that's what inspires us to do the same. Maybe to do something that we never did before. And we feel, I want to take the risk of opening myself to that level with that particular person because I'm feeling I'm receiving so much of that from that side. So that is giving me strength to try myself. So the point is, it's reciprocal. So there is an intimate connection. I mean, ideally speaking, if a disciple is surrendered, the guru is surrendered, there you won't find any more intimate connection than that. So naturally, whatever one or the other person does will affect oneself, as what any close relationship you have in your life. I mean, it's affecting you to the point of making you a different person. And as an aside, but that is quite connected, that's why people fear so much love. Which sounds like an oxymoron, no? Because love and fear are like the opposite of one another, fear and love. But when you speak about love, everyone, again, speaks about love, but in substance, in reality, most of the people is totally terrified about loving or being loved or entering into that particular type of commitment. Because why? Because if you love someone and you are loved by other, and guru-disciple is one of those exchanges, I'm not just limiting the notion to romanticism or something, but we are speaking about here guru-disciple relationship. Love means that I open myself to such a degree to receive the other person, to make the other person part of me, that person will transform me. I will stop being who I am to become something ideally more. But most people do not want to stop being what they are. I mean, they need, but in their system, they are afraid of being something else. That someone else will change me. I don't want to give that person the password to have such a power of me, such an influence. But that's the idea of love. You relate so closely that each one will transform each other. If you are not willing to pay that price, okay, but you will be deprived of that particular experience of love. And of course, the relationship guru-disciple is ideally based on love, or it should evolve in that direction. So we could say that this is also, of course, has to do with levels, degrees, no? Because sometimes, yeah, Shastras say guru takes the karma of the disciple. But that also speaks from a, if you will, idealistic perspective, in the sense that sometimes Shastra says, okay, it happens like that, but it happens like that with the presupposition that the disciple is someone who will surrender to the guru fully. So if that is like that, that will happen like that. Krishna says something similar in the Bhagavad Gita. Aham tvam sarva papibhyo mokshashi syami masuchaha sarva dharmam parityaja mamekam saranam. Surrender to me and I take care of all your sinful reactions. And he's truly saying that. But that will be proportional to how much we surrender. It's not that surrender or not surrender. You have 30%, 47% surrender. There are so many shades of gray between black and white. So the same happens with that. If you are a really surrendered disciple, your guru took all your karma. And from that moment on, there will be no more karma in your life. If you are totally surrendered. If we speak from that perspective, totally surrender, no more karma, of course. You are no longer under that influence of papa, punya, of merit, of piety and sin. I mean, a surrendered disciple has nothing to do with papa and punya. Only has to do with bhakti and aparat. So you have to be careful. That's another type of currency. Bhakti and aparat. Aparat means offense to bhakti. But papa and punya, sin and piety, that person is beyond that. If that person is, again, surrendered to bhakti, to this conception of bhakti and so on. So, to begin with, and I'm sorry if I got stuck in this first line, we have like 10 more here and other questions. But yeah, this will be, of course, being guru is one of the most, if not the most difficult service. Some people have this, like, again, romantic idea, oh, the guru having such a nice time and traveling and garlands and big plate and more hijais than the rest of us. All superficial considerations. I mean, it's such a degree of demand and commitment and dealing with so many situations in main part with other people, no? Because of course, even for that, the guru has to be on a certain level of spiritual standing that his own inner world is not much of a problem, but he or she will have to deal with a lot of the inner world of the other people who are still problematic in problematic situations. Imagine if the guru himself, herself, is like ups and downs. But imagine if you put on top of that the ups and downs of a whole large list of disciples. That won't last for long. We have seen that in history, in every tradition. So that's why it is said that ideally a guru, someone who will serve in that capacity, has to have certain minimum level of inner standing of adhikar to be able to deal with all that implies being a guru. So that to begin with. So then the question continues saying, recently many of Prabhupada's senior disciples caught COVID in India, and this point was heavily implied, the point of disciples, the guru suffering because of the disciples' behavior. This was heavily implying the social media updates, but this contrary to the understanding that Ananya Bhaktas are directly under the control of Krishna's internal potency. So, one observation there. Yeah, of course, I would personally not make that point, because, but there are many considerations here. You know, for example, say, Ananya Bhakta means a devotee who has no separate desire, basically. Ananya means other, like separate interest. And Ananya means non-separate interest. Ananya chintayantamam dhyana pariupashate tesam nitya viyuktamam yoga khima bahamyaham, Krishna says in the Gita. To that devotee of mine who has no separate interest and who is linked with me in the most intimate way, I personally carry what they lack and preserve what they have. I do the personal delivery of all the goods they need and so on. And I take away whatever they don't need comprehensive treatments from tip to toe. So there it speaks about ananya, you know, someone who exclusively is focused on me. Sometimes ananya bhakta may be a synonym for sudha bhakta, or pure devotee, with no separate interest. Anya vilasita sunyam, it's a similar idea. So here the question presupposes the notion that certain senior disciples of Prabhupada, being ananya bhaktas, are under the full control of Krishna's internal energy, mahatmanas tumam partam daivim prakriti masrita. And of course, I won't deny that in some cases, but also we shouldn't necessarily make the assumption that whoever is a Prabhupada disciple, whoever is a senior Prabhupada disciple, whoever is a guru, is necessarily an ananya bhakta. Not necessarily that's the case, which of course doesn't mean that that person has no connection with Krishna's internal energy, but there are, again, degrees of that. So according to those degrees, one may be susceptible to different influences yet. So that's an important point, and not to just, like, assume, I don't know, because sometimes those ideas are there, no? If someone is a guru, of course, for you to be a guru, ideally, you have to have certain level of standing, as we mentioned. But even that doesn't mean that you are a pure devotee. Sometimes the term pure devotee is quite generic. No, you are a pure devotee or you are a struggling bhakta or something like that. No, there are not too much in between layers of struggle and purity either. And of course, pure devotee, no? with which stage it corresponds and so on. So that's one point. No, not necessarily every person is an ananya bhakta. And of course, on top of that, if a devotee, whether it may be an ananya bhakta or not, becomes affected by COVID, which we have seen it happen to every different types of devotees of different standings, if you will, and not only COVID. So many things, you can analyze the life of devotees, and this is a classical topic of, well, if you are a devotee, surrender devotee, Krishna will take care of you. Yes, but what does it mean Krishna will take care of you? Sometimes we, again, create some presuppositions, like this will mean that Krishna takes care of me, and we are just projecting what we think is good for me, and basically that has nothing to do with surrender, because surrender to begin with means I'm open for God to reveal in my life what He considers best for me, and I'm open to accept His opinion above mine. I'm open to trust in that particular vision, above vision. So, with this, I mean, a devotee who is surrendered, it doesn't mean that Krishna will, no more problems, or this won't happen, no COVID, or this or that. But I will provide whatever specific situation will be more favorable for that particular devotee in that particular stage. Krishna, in the famous verse in the Bhagavatam, said, Yasya anugrinami, yasya ham anugrinami, taddhanam harisye taddhanam shanai. He says, to that person that I want to show my favor, this is a pretty scary verse. You already imagine how it follows. Krishna says, first line, to that person that I want to specially favor personally myself, yasya aham, to whom I anugrinami, I want to favor, harisye, what it means harisye? Harisye taddhanam, what does it mean taddhanam? What means dhana? Okay, you know the verse, although you don't want to tell it. I take away all the wealth. But he says chanai. Chanai means step by step. Morsel after morsel, bite by bite. In a user-friendly way, I deprive him of everything. Of course, what does he mean? I deprive him of everything, basically. I take all those things that are being an obstacle that person is attached to, and I give myself to that person. So, I mean, that's a pretty good business. He takes away everything and gives himself. He's everything. So what's the everything he took away? I mean, there's nothing. That's our false sense of everything. And everything is being given to us in the form of everything. Om purnamada, purnamada. But he does such a treatment. So that's my point. In every case, not necessarily he, Krishna, will have to take away everything. I mean, he will take away those things that are promoting, again, a false sense of identity and so on. But in cases that's not happening, Krishna may provide or maintain the opulence of some devotee, because he knows, oh, that devotee knows, acknowledge that that opulence does not belong to him, that is my energy, and he's using properly in my service. So not only I will take care of that, I will give him more. And we know of many devotees who are wealth on a filthy level, basically. And in other cases, we know the examples of devotees being sincere but attached to something, and Krishna organizing some tragic stage, scenario there for them to receive the necessary like shock treatment and awake to whatever they needed. No? Some suffering involved. I mean, most of the, you read Bhagavad Gita, I mean, Arjuna is not in a precisely comfortable situation. No? Parikshit Maharaj, I mean, 7 days to die. I mean, you are thrown out of your comfort zone. So my point here is that. No? So if some devotee is having COVID, my point is this, and that devotee is surrender, even Ananya Bhakta, it doesn't mean that, oh, he won't have COVID. It doesn't have to do one thing with the other, no? Because, I mean, every pure devotee will have something at one point. I mean, will leave his body, her body, with some problem in his heart, some whatever, something. The body fails. And you won't say, oh, Krishna didn't took care of him. Well, doesn't mean that he will never leave this body. Something will fail in that particular level of the vehicle. But it doesn't mean that Krishna is not taking care of that person. But actually will nourish the journey of that person in such a way that all those other failures on a physical level are just nourishing his bhakti. So I don't think it's wise to say, oh, my Gurudev got COVID. That's because some of his disciples have failed in their vows. And you are the ones to be, you are responsible for what's going on with him. Mm-hmm. If you wouldn't be such a rascal personality, he will be healthy now. That's not wise to tell. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, sometimes we do that. No? And that's not promoting a healthy sense of responsibility. Because you are ascribing excessive responsibility on someone. A layer of responsibility has nothing to do with you. Maybe that person is having COVID and Krishna is managing that. Because if the devotee surrendered, that devotee is under the jurisdiction of Krishna's direct control. So he considers that to happen. That's a particular reason for that. So instead of honoring Krishna's will on that surrendered devotee, we are creating neurosis by blaming another devotee who maybe very sincerely struggling in his, her practice, still failing, ups and downs, but trying to continue. And maybe in his struggle, you've just come with that load of excessive, unnecessary guilt and shame, not even responsibility. No, because of this, Gurudev, this, and you end up burying that person who is trying to, maybe struggle with some whatever issue, but if that will be like the checkmate. I mean, you end up killing that person, in one sense. And that can be Vaishnava Parada, basically, in the name of protecting my guru's health and so on. So here the question continues with this idea, no? As a result, sometimes disciples, to protect their guru who is undergoing bodily discomfort, adopt almost vigilant behavior against disciples who have fallen away. But again, that's not solving the problem. That's not giving real insight about what's actually happening. It just remains on the platform of blaming and looking for some, again, enemy outside and creating a false sense of responsibility, actually. Who again, the guru may be affected by my disciple is doing some nonsense. I'm affected in the sense that I love him. I want him the best. I suffer because I love him. I mean, if you love someone, you risk yourself to a form of suffering also. Not in a selfish way, but in another way, compassionate way. Compassion is a form of suffering. I mean, if you don't suffer, you cannot have compassion. Compassion means you are suffering. But in such a way that your heart is expanding. Now, there is another way of suffering without expansion of the heart. That's useless. And we are to avoid that suffering which comes as a result of selfishness, frustration, ignorance, but out of compassion. That's a very desire to suffering. So guru might suffer because of that, but another thing is to ascribe, again, he's sick because you are doing this, he's sick because you are doing that. So yeah, the question is this behavior anukool to bhakti? Well, I think I already made that clear. It is not. Actually, something to be following the second part of the rule, which is pratikule asya varjana. To avoid those things which are unfavorable for bhakti. So to enter into some form of paranoia and blame people and try to just take care in an external way. And to begin with, again, just going to this last part of the question, because the last part say Rupa Goswami say that one should not accept too many unqualified disciples just to increase sampradaya numbers. So how to understand and reconcile. So also that's a point. For if you are about to embrace the service of being a guru, I mean, you have to be honest about what's your capacity, where are you standing on, what's the level of, if you will, even empowerment that is flowing through you, and how much you can deal with that. Because if you accept more disciples that you can deal with, that will overwhelm you. It doesn't mean that you cannot accept any disciple, but everything has to be done like a father, no? If you are a father, you may have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, I think you can stop there, children. You cannot have like 355 children. You cannot, unless you are like, I don't know, some particular avatar that can deal with that, but generally there is some capacity. So once, of course, we know the famous story, Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta was speaking about this verse of Rupa Goswami, which actually is not saying one should not accept too many unqualified disciples, but he said one should not accept too many disciples. Another thing, one should not read too many books, one should not open too many temples. And one disciple, he was saying all this, and one student from Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta asked him, but Guru Maharaj, yes, you are doing that exactly. You have thousands of disciples, 64 maths, you study a lot, and so on. So how to accommodate? No, of course, his reply was common sense, which is some of the less common senses nowadays. You know, people doesn't have too much common sense. But that's very important. The other day I was thinking about that as an aside, because I was studying one of these verses where Rupa Goswami describes the symptoms of an Uttam Adhikari. And he says, Uttam Adhikari Shastra Nipun. He's a genius concerning scriptures. And then he says, Yukta Nipun. He's a genius also concerning logic. And logic does not necessarily mean he's expert in the Nyaya system of logic, but he has logic. Logic is another way of putting that is common sense. Mm-hmm. He is a genius about common sense, which means a genius about what the scriptures say, by a genius about how to apply those statements according to time, place, circumstances. Because if you quote Shastra without common sense, you are not quoting Shastra. You are misquoting Shastra scriptures. So quoting of revelation has to be accompanied with common sense. So Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta gave a very common sensical reply when he was not accused, but just asked about, but you are doing all that. And he said, well, that's a matter of personal capacity. What's too much? What's too many disciples? For one, for some people, as I say, to have 100 disciples is a lot. For another people, to have one disciple is a lot. For another people, to be a disciple is a lot. So it's a matter of personal capacity. The same with reading books or opening temples. So what's too much or too little? That has to do with one's individual capacity. You have to study yourself and see what's my limit, what's my capacity, and not transgress that. So that's what Rupa Goswami is saying. He's not giving a number. He's not saying too much is 100 an egg, beyond that, illegal, or whatever. He's saying, I mean, have your yardstick at hand and be authentic about yourself and do not, again, create a false character in the name of whatever, being a devotional superhero or something. So that's the point. If you are to embrace or to accept being a guru as a service to the Sampradaya, okay, that's fine. That's glorious. That's needed. But also that's to be done in a certain way, because if you are not doing that properly, that could create one of the main type of damages to the leaders. So one who is to be a guru, one has to know all that thing. How I will be able to maintain myself, how I will be able to relate with my disciple, the situation of my disciples to the level that whatever happens to them is not affecting me on a level, on a certain level that it starts to affect my practice in a way that won't be healthy for me and for them. So those things have to be thought about. How many disciples can I have? Because, again, it's a personal interaction. You have to have relation with your disciple. How Krishna describes a guru and a disciple, tadviripratipatina pariprasnena sivaya. We say pariprasnena, pariprasna. There has to be humble inquiry with your guru. So humble inquiry means you can speak with the guru. And if you have too many disciples, you may not be able to, you know, don't have time for that. And I'm not blaming those who do that, because I know that some gurus having, I don't know, 10,000 disciples or many more, and which were the situation that took them to accept that number, but at least a system somehow should be established for those 10,000 disciples to have a connection with their guru in the form of some other representatives or somehow, so they may be able to inquire and have personal interaction, personal connection. Because if that's not in place, the whole principle of how a disciple is expected to interact with the guru is lost. There's which Vishramba you can have, no intimacy. No, if you are not even able to ask a question or to speak or something. And again, originally that was the case. No, the guru will have her gurukula, living in the hut with some number of disciples. No, not 3,000, but a few number, and here they will interact. No. So again, some considerations in every particular case. The situation is, of course, entirely individual, and so many things are to consider. But at least some thoughts I want to share. I hope that helps. I'll follow with the second question by Namrasa Prabhu. He's sending here one question. It says like this. Some devotees preach that Vrindavan is a state of mind and the actual place is not as important. Can you please give your thoughts on this? Shri Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. So, of course, I mean, the idea that Vrindavan is a state of mind or a state of consciousness is, we receive that from Shastra, but of course, that's a concept that generally is, when that appears, is in connection to Mahaprabhu. So, to begin with, more mana Vrindavan. Mahaprabhu himself is saying, my mind is Vrindavan. So wherever I am, I'm Vrindavan. The classical example is himself being outside of Vrindavan, but seeing Vrindavan everywhere. Right after he accepted sannyasis, we know he wanted to run to Vrindavan, and Nityananda Prabhu cheated on him and had everything prepared for all the inhabitants of Navadvip to have one more darshan of Mahaprabhu as a sannyasi at Shantipur, the place of Advaita Acharya. So he started to take Mahaprabhu to Shantipur, telling him, I'm taking you to Vrindavan. And when they saw the Ganges, Nityananda said, oh, you see the Jamuna is here. So we are getting closer. And when they are about to reach Advaita Acharya's home, Nityananda told the local children, if he asks you where we are, you tell him that we are just arriving to Vrindavan. Mm-hmm. So, and Nityananda Prabhu gave some candies to the children or whatever. No? So all the children, okay. So Mahaprabhu was like in trance, you know, in ecstasy, walking and close to Vrindavan, all the children, yes, almost arriving there. So Mahaprabhu, yeah. For him, it was not, he was immersed in that, or he already arrived there, if you will. He He was not being cheated about going somewhere else because he already arrived to the place he wanted to go physically. And what to speak, when he was in Puri, he will see the ocean and he will just mistake every wave of the ocean with the Jamuna and jump there in a particular bhav. When he saw, as we say the other day, Chatak Parvat, he wouldn't see Chatak Parvat, he will see Govardhan and will recite the famous verse, Hantai Madhira Valahari Das Sabarya, as we studied these days, the Vinugita, and so on. So, he was in Vrindavan, and for him, Vrindavan was a state of consciousness. Sorry. You want with this? Of course, the question is how much we can follow that, how much we can, I mean, imitate. You cannot imitate Mahaprabhu. Don't try it at home. That may be dangerous, especially in the Antilila. But the question, of course, here is, some people say Vrindavan is a state of mind. And in this case, that's in Shastra again, because again, we can enter into some. I heard that someone say, but did he say somewhere that's in Shastra? But the point is, in the name of that, sometimes the Dhambhas, or the rest, the physical residence, if you will, in the Dham, can be downplayed. So how much that is proper, or which are my thoughts on that, and so on. But I would say that both sides of the coin can be abused, no? As usual, as with everything. No? The two things can be abused. And we have that facility. We have that very easy, cheap potential to do that. No? Like to take one stance like, no, the Dham is a stage of consciousness. So do I don't need to go India anywhere. Whatever I may be, I can be in Vrindavan. Yes, but, I mean, where are you standing to say that? I mean, how much you're walking the talk? How much you don't need a particular external environment to help you to enter in a particular inner situation? So again, that has a lot with your internals. And the other extreme situation, no? Which is, no, physical residence in the Dham is everything. Like almost implying, it doesn't matter where you are internally. If your body is in the Dham, that's done. But that's not like that either. I'm saying the two extremes, of course. No? The two extremes of the coin, which are equally unhealthy, I would say. No? Because you can be in Vrindavan. Vrindavan is one of the sacred places in our tradition. But you can be there with a totally mundane... I remember Brajasundari asked something like that some years ago, no, regarding dying in the Dham, right? We were given the lecture on the calving over there. So, not the same question, but similar. So, you can be saying, no, I'm in Vrindavan, my body is in Vrindavan. I don't know internally where you are, but you may be doing a big list of nonsense in Vrindavan. You can find, I mean, prostitution and exploitation of people and kidnapping and thievery. So what does it mean that no problem, they're in Vrindavan, so when they leave the body they will go to Golok Vrindavan? That's not like that. I mean, if you analyze the 10 offenses to the Holy Dham, and if you really play out the implications of the 10 apparat, the Dham apparat, I mean, they are pretty clear about you are to stay there in a certain mood to really be there. Because if you are engaging in aparad or offense, how much you are there, how much you are deriving a devotional benefit from being there. For example, one of the offenses is to make a business with deity worship or having a temple or things like that, or to commit violence towards any living being entity there. Or I don't know, to consider the Dham as temporary. So some people may be physically there and thinking all these things. So how much they are there. And that's why Srila Jiva Goswami, he mentioned, when Srila Rupa Goswami is mentioning the importance of residing in the Dham, because again, I don't want also to downplay that. And he describes his 64 angas of bhakti, at the end he gives 64, 559, and then he finishes the last five, like a summarizing of the most important of the first 59. Say Sadhu Sangha Namakirtan Bhagavat Shravan Mathura Vas Srimurtir Sradaya Sevan. So Sadhu Sangha, association with the saintly. Namakirtan, singing the name, Kirtan. Bhagavat Shravan, hearing of Srimad Bhagavatam. Mathura Vas, residing in Mathura, which is another way of saying Vrindavan. And Murtir Sradaya Sevan, worship Srimurti with faith. So one of them is residing in Vrindavan. But Srila Jiva Goswami comments there. Well, if one cannot recite physically, at least one should try to recite mentally in the Dhamma. Which, of course, that's not easy. No. Because one could say, okay, I cannot recite physically, but I will recite mentally. Okay, but you have to. What does it mean to recite mentally in the Dhamma also? There's so many questions that we need to really play out the implications of those in many ways. To recite mentally in one place means to enter into the prevalent mood of the place. What's the psychology of the inhabitants of that place? In that case means, what's the psychology of the Vrajavasis that we want to follow in our Raganuga Marg project? And how to live in that particular state. It's not something that you play a button, I'm there. Going to Vrindavan, as our Guru Maharaj teaches, is not just, I got a ticket, I'm there. That's part of the equation, but that's not the all-in-all. Physically, you may move your body inside the sacred space, but we need to be there comprehensively. So sometimes it's important to clarify this. I mean, in one sense, it is better to be outside of the Dham physically, but present internally, than to be inside the Dham physically, but outside internally. You follow? Of course, one can try to be physically and internally, and that's great. I mean, if you can be internally, you will be able to draw all the benefit of being there, in a place that Krishna executed so many pastimes and the environment is providing so much udipana for bhakti, so much stimulant. I mean, that's a fact. I mean, if you go to a place like Vrindavan or Navadvipa Puri, I mean, this, and in the environment there is a lot of stimulants that will remind you of Krishna constantly. Of course, there are another list of challenges as well for each person particularly, but we won't deny the favorability of of that experience. But again, also each case is different. For some persons of certain situation in life or psychology, whatever, there may be some levels of cultural shock and they maybe get stuck in those things and not being able to fully appreciate all that the Dham has to offer, and for some of them may be healthy to be in a situation where the essential atmosphere of the Dham is recreated with some other cultural packaging, if you will. Because it's important also to differentiate those things. It's not that you go to Vrindavan and everything you find there is original in Golok Vrindavan or something, no? There are no riches in Golok Vrindavan. No? Thank God. Or at least they do not honk like that. No? There are birds who... I mean, if you go to Vrindavan nowadays, there are so many things which are totally nonsensical and totally materialistic, and Western influences and pollution and exploitation. But all of those things are to be seen as a relative covering of the Dham, while the real essence of the whole thing is beyond that filter. So the point is, one has to have the capacity to inhabit that place beyond that relative filter to take proper advantage of that. If not, you just get stuck on the surface and end up judging everything and maybe committing offense. So in those cases, for some people, it may be more healthy to be in a situation that may be more culturally favorable in some of those relativities more in place, and they can be more attentive and focused to be in the Dham mentally, if you will, to enter into the proper mood of what's the Dham. So again, I'm trying to share ideas in support of of both points, no? If you will, of reciting in the Dham, and which are the pros of that, but also certain considerations for those who, for some reason, and that's maybe the case of most of the devotees, maybe, for some reason they cannot live there permanently, physically, but they are invited, if you will, or distraction is there to reside there mentally. So the main question for all of us will be, I think, how myself living in, I don't know, whatever. I mean, I cannot tell too much, I'm traveling all day, but in Costa Rica, in the United States, or whatever you are, how can I reside in the Dham? How I can engage in Dham Bhas on an internal level? How can I adjust my daily schedule in such a way that I inhabit that sacred space on a daily basis? I think that's a question worthy of exploration for most of the members of our community. Because again, we can say, no, residing in the place is not so important, again, to bring down its state of consciousness. Yes, but again, what are you doing for that to happen in your life? If you are not doing what you have to be doing, those type of statements become an excuse. Do not become real truth. And they are truth if you are walking the talk. If you are not walking the talk, you are using that as a tool for being evasive and justifying the unjustifiable or something like that. So it all depends what's the background behind this statement, from where you are saying that, how much you are inhabiting the concept, if you will. Because we have so many nice concepts, no? We have so many high, refined ideas and very nice quotes, but I mean, that's not all. You have to do something with that. And that can be very dangerous, because if you have a body of knowledge that provides you with all the perfect answers and all the nice, beautiful concepts, you can just like make a perfect like surrounding wall around you with, and you know what to say at every moment and everything, you have some poetic and mystical answer to give. But internally, how much you are dealing with that, how much that's touching your heart, what are you doing to, again, inhabit those ideas? Or you are just invoking them when the situation requires. Or Vrindavan is a state of consciousness. And then you go to do whatever nonsense or something. Those ideas are not just to escape reality, but to, on the contrary, I mean, to further your embrace of reality. So again, that's a very intimate personal question that all of us had to resolve, again, with our pillow every single night. So those are my thoughts, Narasa. I hope that helps. So what else? I think we have some time. We can give many hands here. Follow-up? Which is more follow-up of the two?
I don't know, yours probably. Mine's kind of simple.
Let's go with Brad Sundar and then Gongkar. We'll give time for the two.
I was thinking, because I remember I kind of know even a person like that, but there are some devotees who, after reading, I don't remember exactly what book it was, but it was a book by some previous acharya saying, like, do whatever, steal, or become a prostitute, but remain in Vrindavan.
Mm-hmm.
So I know there are people who just do it to be physically in Vrindavan.
Mm.
And they say, oh, if you commit aparada, you just become a monkey for one lifetime, and then you go back to Goloka.
Mm. As I say, no? Shastra, Yinipum, but Yukta also. No? So you have to have common sense to know how to understand those statements. No? Because if you didn't hear the one connected, Raj Sundar was saying some people may invoke some quotes from Shastra, which may say, yeah, you can. I mean, you have to be in Vrindavan, whatever it takes, even if you have to be a prostitute to be there, you have to be there, and maybe some of them will say, but if you are engaged in something improper, you may be as much born as a monk in Vrindavan and then go back to Godhead and go to Goloka or something. But that's not working. I mean, it sounds nice and you can convince yourself of that, but I mean, how much you are, again, doing your best to actually do what is necessary to attain Golok Vrindavan, I don't think that, no, I'm doing my best. I'm being a very nice prostitute here. I'm doing my best. No, I don't think so. No. And some of those statements want to make a point. Which is that the point is not becoming prostitute. Even if you are a prostitute, that will be good. So, but in Vrindavan. Outside of Vrindavan, you go to hell. Inside of Vrindavan, you go to heaven. Something like that. I mean, those statements want to make a point about the power of the place. You know? Like when we hear this Kaimutyanyaya statements in Shastra, which mean, I don't know, which say, like, if you chant the name of Krishna unattentively, you become free from all karma. So maybe you think, wow, I was suffering so much for chanting unattentively all those years, but now I hear that I will free from all karma by chanting that. So now I won't struggle with unattentiveness, but I will culture that. Because I will free from all karma just by being distracted. So I will promote distraction in my life so I can be free from all karma. No, that was not the point of the verse. Not the point of the verse was, if by chanting unattentively you are free from all karma, what must it be? What must it happen if you chant attentively? The verse is not promoting inattentive chanting for living free from karma, but attentive chanting for attaining prem, which is much way above mukti. Similarly, some statements which may say, it doesn't matter what you are in Vrindavan, do whatever nonsense you want, but just be in Vrindavan and you will receive everything. They want to make a point about the power of the place, and you may get some benefit, but not to the point of making that like the main aspect of your sadhana. No? I mean, I will be a prostitute in the dham, and I'll go to Golok, maybe a monkey in between, but then Golok Vrindavan. I don't ask your guru about that. I don't think you will receive blessing for such conception, such reading of Shastra. So again, we have Shastra, we have so many quotes, but we need to understand what the scriptures say with proper guidance, because if not, you can make a whole prostitution business in the name of Shastra. And that's not what Shastra is promoting. No? I mean, it's just mentioning certain elements, but many of those elements have to do with people doing those things, quote unquote, innocently. No. Innocently, I mean, not in a calculated way. Okay, I'll go there, I will do this, and I will attain that. But someone who is in Vrindavan and casually, if you will, engage in some of those things, still there is some benefit for the fact of being in that place. But not if you read the verse and say, okay, so then I will do this. And it's the same with Namabasa, for example. In the Bhagavatam, all different types of Namabasa are mentioned, but those apply to those who chant without knowing about the effects of the name. Chanting unattentively, trying to refer to something else using the name of Krishna. In Spanish, we have the word Rama a lot, or like branch, or so many other things. So, I mean, some people work with trees, they are acquiring heaps of Namabasa. Rama, Rama, cut the Rama. But they are not aware that, oh, this is the name of God, and I'm chanting Namabasa. They do not know they are chanting Namabasa. But they have some benefit. But when you get to know those things, there comes a price to pay because of you being conscious of something. So it's not a, oh, if I only say Ram inattentively, I will. No, that's not really. No. That becomes Namaparad, actually. That becomes Namaparad, not Namavas. So this type of statement have to do with the same thing. Now, if some of those things happen accidentally, casually, inattentively, some result will be there. Not to the point of Golok Vrindavan or something. But if you already are aware and educated about what to do, what not to do, and so on, it doesn't work like the same way. It's like if someone is, for example, in Shastra we hear about the karmic consequences of eating meat. But there are degrees of that. If you are not aware about the consequences of eating meat, the consequences won't be the same as if you are aware of those consequences. I mean, if a child of 5 years kills a person accidentally, on a legal level, he won't be put to jail or something, because he was not aware of the consequences of that. Or if an adult kills someone, goes to jail, generally. So, again, all the things have to be considered, and not just do copy paste of some verses and organize a prostitution project or something in the town. No, I mean, maybe that was done by someone. I mean, I don't joke. Oh, you can find every crazy thing in the name of the highest idea. That's pretty unbecoming. But what to do? That's why we need teachers for us to approach sacred texts, because the texts are there, and somehow they will make sense for you with whatever idea you approach them. You follow? I mean, if you approach with any, you can take any sacred text and draw from them whatever meaning you want. If you approach with that mode, and that's why you need a guru that will be the filter of that and will tell you, no, it doesn't mean this. It doesn't mean what you think it means. It means this. Because if not, you take any book, and you can, again, as I say yesterday, you take the Bible, the Bhagavad Gita, and you become a serial killer. The creator of the atomic bomb, Oppenheimer, he was inspired by the Gita to create that. You know that when the bomb was exploding, he quoted this verse of the 11th chapter. Krishna says, "I'm time destroyer of all." So you say, okay, I don't think Krishna was intending that. So you need parampara, Mr. Oppenheimer. So things like this. No? Omka.
What's the difference between Vaishnava Aparad and Vaishnava Ninda?
No difference.
Really? Because today I read something that said that Vaishnava opera can lead into Vaishnava Inda. And again,
where you read that?
I was reading this book by, what's his name? Vinam Bihar Baba. His Obstacles for Bhakti. And he talks about their quite doom and gloom style. He talks about this Vaishnava Inda. First chapter is Vaishnava Inda.
And what's the difference he makes there?
Well, he says one can lead into another, that's why I was confused.
But how he defines each?
I can find the quote.
Yeah, you can see. But
that's what I thought.
Generally, the notion is the same. Sadhu Ninda, Vaishnava Aparad, Shastra Ninda. I mean, indeed, those terms are used in the list of 10 Nama Aparad. Shastra Ninda. Generally, it's the same. So maybe, yeah, understanding the context, he's... Sometimes some sadhus may take a term that generally is used to say the same thing with two different words, and then may use those two different words to indicate some degrees of gravity of the same thing. I don't know. We have to check the details. Okay. Any other question before finishing? Whether a few present here, view present there. Okay, so we can leave it here. Thank you so much for your time. Srila Gurudev ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Sri Sri Dauji Gopal ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Kotriman Haribo, Vancha Kalpataru Vishta, Kripa Sindhu Pyai Vacha, Pati Tanam Pavani Pyo Vaishnavetya Namo Ananta Koti Vaishnava Brahma Ki Jai Gaur Hari Bol.